My name is Gary Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs. It is a Games Club podcast.
And this week we're talking about Blasphemous 2, which is a Metroidvania game developed by the Game Kitchen and published by Team 17 for the PC and consoles in 2023.
Yeah, and it is our premium episode for this month. And so that means everybody's getting this part. Our patrons at $5 a month will get the entire episode. Whole premium. And this is part of our kind of restructure for the year. We do these every couple of years. We do a restructure of moving Bonfireside Chat to seasonal and then covering non-FromSoft Souls likes we're interested in on WoF.
Yes. And this was at the top of our list of ones we wanted to check out.
Brave fools. You little idiots. I don't think this is going to this. So neither of us like this a whole lot.
Yeah. Fair to say, right?
It's not a disaster. Right. But neither of us like it a whole lot. This has nothing to do with where we're covering it. I just want to point that out. I don't necessarily think anyone's going to think it did, but we're not giving this short shrift because we're doing it here.
Yeah.
It would just be two episodes.
Right.
If we did it on Bonfireside Chat, but they would have been shorter. And also, I would have felt the same way.
I would have. Yes.
Yeah.
So get that counterfactual out of your head. Yeah, this is a bummer. And if you were expecting us to be really glowing, if Blasphemous is really close to your heart as a franchise or as a series, know that we like the first one.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is they don't got the juice on this one.
Yeah, it left me really cold. And it was a surprise, like genuine surprise. I was slavering like this was a candy. You know, I was like, oh, man, this is going to be fun. I got this to look forward to. Big surprise. And just like going down is one of my big gaming disappointments, which is a weird thing to say for a game that the worst thing I can say about it is it's like a fairly unmemorable B minus. You know, it's not horrible.
Yeah,
I just had high expectations. You know, and it's just I think there are interesting things to talk about in this in how the positive side of neither fish nor fowl. Right. Like that's something you say as we'll say is like a negative.
Yeah.
But the first one is kind of neither fish nor fowl to its strength.
Yes.
You know, and just something being too clean. This is too clean. It's too tight and too clean. You know how it works. Like it just feels I can see all of the formula to it. It feels a little bit like I asked an AI to like design a map for a Metroidvania and design abilities for a Metroidvania. And then they did it.
Yeah.
You know, it feels so weirdly cookie cutter for a series. And this is all mechanical, not flavor.
Yeah.
The flavor is still weird. It's not quite as weird, which I think is a bummer. But the flavor is still weird. But mechanically, it's just like, what if a Metroidvania?
Yeah.
You know, with slightly more demanding combat.
And I, you know, I'll even go so far as to say is that like, yeah, if this was released with this flavor without Blasphemous 1 having existed before it, this would be phenomenal. Like, holy shit. From a flavor perspective and a Flair perspective.
Yes. And Ric Flair's perspective.
Ooh,
I don't know if he's a gamer, but we can probably find out.
Yeah. But like, I think that this also does not stand in the shadow of Blasphemous 1 very well. A lot of this feels like retread. a retread of something very cool, but I was expecting a little bit more addition in this. Going Same. And seeing new, you know, slight variations and iterations on the idea of this kingdom and the Grievous Miracle is nowhere near as interesting to me as learning about it for the first time and seeing the further extremes that they go to in the first game.
It is also, it came back. Like, yeah. the method in which it came back is kind of interesting, mm-hmm. but it is, what if the Grievous Miracle came back?
You know, somehow the Grievous Miracle came back.
It's got that real Brayden Cameron joke about Myst 2 with the same demon on the front that just says, guess who's back? You know? And it's also, I want to throw this out there, we're outliers in this.
Yep.
This is a really loved game, and mm-hmm. the main thing I've seen people say about it is that, yeah, the flavor's not quite as good, but it's so much tighter mechanically. And I just don't agree with that. And that's okay. Like,
no.
I might be the outlier, should be part of your basic kit.
Yep.
Like, you know, that's something you should internalize. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's going to be possible. You're an individual. Your way of looking at something can't be the standard by which it's judged. You know, right. It's why, you know, I'm always saying, like, you know, I might be the weirdo here, or I am the weirdo here. Mm-hmm. This is what I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's a rare case where we're both the same weirdo about it, though.
Yeah. And I imagine there's going to be other people, too. And I feel like on two particular points, the things that this does, I think are like, you know, strict downgrades. Things that mm-hmm. bother me, I think, are. Yeah. We'll get
more subjective.
It.
Yeah. We'll get to all of it. It's worth getting all that out there, though, because I want to prime anybody who is prepped for a love fest because they really love this. Mm-hmm. Just because if you don't like listening to something that you really liked being called a unmemorable B minus.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it might not be for you.
Yeah. Also, you know, just remember that we hate video games and we want you not to like them too.
We also get more money when we don't like them.
Yes. So we
can't tell you who's paying us more to like mm-hmm. them. It's certainly not patrons. Yeah. They don't get, it's not like they get mad and depatronized because we didn't like a video game, because that's certainly something that doesn't happen. No, it's a shadowy cabal. It's the same people that keep the price of gold down.
Yep. So this is a sequel to the 2019 game Blasphemous. Mm-hmm. We covered that on Bonfireside Chat. Those are premium episodes from when we returned. That's episodes 149, 150, and 151. And I think I was a little bit warmer on Blasphemous 1 than you were. While both of us still being kind of like, oh, this is a standout. Like, for me, from that season of like looking at more Souls-likes, it was this in Grime that stood out as being like, holy shit, if you like, you know, run, don't walk, you know, these are the examples of the form, right?
I like Death's Gambit a little bit more than I like this.
Yes.
And largely a mechanical thing.
I always forget about Death's Gambit is the thing. Oh, I love it too.
The loathsome Death's Gambit, the furtive Death's Gambit. My issues were mechanical. Yes. Like, I love the flavor of Blasphemous mm-hmm. 1. You can listen to those. Those are premium. So if you're a patron, mm-hmm. not only do you get the premium episodes of this, but you get that as well. That game and this game, essentially, take place in the Kingdom of Custodia. This is a realm scourged by the suffering imposed by something called the Grievous Miracle.
Yeah.
Which is a force that spread kind of ironic punishments and boons to some people mm-hmm. In the first one to reward religious devotion.
Right.
One of the things that's different is it seems like it's oops all punishments now.
Yeah.
which is one of the things that the flavor is a little lacking to me. Mm-hmm. There's a little less of like, be careful what you wish for, and more of just like, now you're a fucked up thing.
You know, I hope you weren't too attached to your skin.
it's a little bit more, I hope you weren't too attached to your skin, and a little less like, you wish to have the most beautiful skin in the universe, so we coated you in gold.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. Like, it's a little less Wishmaster, a little more dick.
Yep.
Master. Like,
you know, I thought the Dick Master series kind of trailed off once they hit 7.
Yeah, well, they didn't get the guy back.
Yeah. So you play as the Penitent One, a member of this Orderhood, bound to silence, wearing a cool metal cone hat. And in the first game, you wake up from the dead and attempt to unseat the head of the church to end the reign of the miracle, killing them. And then ultimately in the DLCs, killing
this is the highest one. Yes. To clarify. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Just give a little bit of history. In the DLC of Blasphemous 1, you end up killing the higher will, kind of the force behind the force. brought the miracle into this world, and seemingly putting the misery of the miracle to rest. Right.
Yeah. The DLCs are very much part of the story to one, mm-hmm. and understanding the story of two, the DLCs help a lot. I've never played those DLCs. I just read about mm-hmm. them.
Yeah.
But it's worth noting those are non-optional DLCs.
Yes.
For this complete plot and for the story to make sense. Mm-hmm. Blasphemous 2 takes place 1,000 years in the future. After that, the miracle is returned and a physical manifestation of it is forming over the kingdom of the main city. Mm-hmm. And you are woken up from the dead basically to stop this. Not quite the dead, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To stop this.
Yeah. This plays very similarly to the predecessor. This is a 2D side-scrolling platformer with some pretty punishing combat. I would say a little bit too punishing in the late game. Mm-hmm. And a Metroidvania structure. You are getting new abilities to unlock different parts of the map, collecting secrets, proceeding to kind of new biomes to follow this quest.
And this is significantly one of the first big changes. And we're going to make comparisons to Blasphemous 1.
Yes.
Because, you know, that partly because it's useful critically because we like the first one and like this one less, but secondly, just because it's the obvious, you know, touch point. It's more of a Metroidvania.
Yes.
So the first one featured a much more kind of open world from the start, mm-hmm. and your Metroidvania navigation abilities were mostly for bonuses.
Right.
There weren't very many places in the first one, and it's really easy to remember this wrong. Like, I mm-hmm. went back and watched footage of the first one to remind myself. That it wasn't about, oh, I need a double jump to get here.
You never get a double jump. Yeah.
Yeah. You could basically go anywhere. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of things that were movement abilities, but mostly that was an open world 2D Souls-like. You know, very punishing combat, this checkpoint structure and everything. It felt more like that.
Yeah.
This really embraces the got to get the double jump, got to get the weapon that is this key mm-hmm. thing. Much more so. Big difference.
Mm-hmm.
The actual combat feels largely the same.
Yes.
You know, there's a parrying system that you can use, and the combat's very demanding, but there's no stamina meter. There's just kind of cooldowns on your attacks. You get a dodge slide that you can mm-hmm. move through smaller enemies. Larger enemies will stop you from this. So kind of, you know, what we think of as Souls-like combat light.
Right. And you have Estus in this. You have healing charges called bile flasks. These refill on death. You can
still
upgrade
one of the
best
animations.
Oh, it's great.
In the game, you smash the bottle over your head. I love that so much.
Which, I mean, even if it's healing you, smashing glass on your face seems like it would be a wash.
It's great. Go back to the Into the Gungeon episode where the nurses in that game, they get a fairy jar from Zelda and ask you to close your eyes for the treatment, and then they just smash it over your head. It's real good.
I love it.
Yeah.
But you can upgrade those both in number and how effective they are.
Yes.
And it has the bonfire structure. There are these little shrines called Priae Deus that you mm-hmm. find. You know, you rest at them. If you die, you respawn there. It resets the world. And when you die, you leave behind this kind of remnant, these little guilt fragments is what they're called.
When you die, you don't lose your currency. Instead, you build up guilt. And this mm-hmm. takes more and more of your maximum fervor meter, which is basically your magic points there. Mm-hmm. You can get this back by reaching your corpse, basically doing a corpse run and reclaiming it, which gives you a little bit of a heal. That's, again, a thing we like, mm-hmm. Or at least I like still. This idea of getting an extra heal in a battle you died in.
They're very helpful. Yeah.
Yes. And there's a risk reward to this where having built up guilt will make the game harder but increases your rewards for killing mm-hmm. enemies. There's kind of a risk reward system to this because, you know, the more you die, you build up this guilt. This cuts down your maximum MP, which is called fervor in this game. And you can recover some of this if you reach your remnant, like basically do your corpse run and pick it up. This also provides a small heal, mm-hmm. which we like, you know, let you get a leg up in a battle that you had mm-hmm. a hard time with. And this is more complicated than this. You can also pay somebody mm-hmm. to get rid of it if you can't be bothered. And having guilt built up makes the game harder, but gives you more rewards for killing enemies. Here is another thing where this kind of falls down for me is I think this game has a very bad economy.
Yeah.
I don't have fun things to spend my stuff on ever.
Mostly wood carvings for a build that I would never in a million years consider doing. Yeah.
Yes. So who gives a shit? Like, and again, you know, we talk about this a lot on the show, but mm-hmm. when you get rid of the value of a currency and currency is the reward for a lot of the things you're doing,
yeah,
you fuck up the equation of game.
There are a lot of exploration rewards. Yeah. Yes. These, you know, like little fonts of gold, you know, sometimes they will have a skill point, these marks of martyrdom, yes, which we'll talk
which
about.
Which I also kind of have an issue with as well. Like, we'll get to that. You know, but this is worse. Like, they'll have $800.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got that huge, like, you know, the Mass Effect, like going on the Citadel and be like, I don't need the $50. I'm not going to do this job for you, you know? And it just, it compounds like a feel bad. And because it's built into this risk reward system where, like, oh, I can run with a lowered MP bar and get more money.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's kind of interesting, but I don't have anything to spend money on. And MP is very useful. And the main thing I spend it on is getting, not having to do corpse runs.
Yeah.
You know, which is also just, I'm never, like, after a certain point in this game, you're never low on money.
Yeah.
And part of that's because you never lose it, but part of it's because there's nothing fun to spend it on.
Yeah, there are a couple of, like, big ticket items. Some of the, like, main upgrade materials are, you know, at some shops, maybe.
Yes.
But that, I mean,
it's some spells that are interesting from time to time.
Yeah.
You know, but for the most part, when I say nothing, I'm exaggerating. There aren't enough things.
After a certain point, nothing. I just keep walking up to the merchant and, you know, saying like, well, and he's like, no, you're not getting anything today. Well,
of course fucking not.
Yeah. You know? Carry something better.
Yeah. You know, not to sound like a capitalist, but, like, I don't know, you're not creating demand.
Yeah.
Weird merchant.
So you mentioned spells. You've got two kinds of spells, these chants and verses. Basically, like a quick spell or like a one that requires a little bit more commitment has more of an effect. And you can have one of each equipped for
yes.
this.
Yeah. And these are generally cool and useful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, spell builds are very viable.
Yeah.
In this. The biggest difference in this game is that you get different weapons. Instead of just the gigantic sword, the Mea Culpa, we have three distinct weapons.
Right.
You get a curved sword called the Ruego el Alba, Ruego. This is a balanced sword. You get wide swings, medium range. You can parry and counterattack if you've done enough damage, or you get a limited break if you do enough damage. That's true of all of them. You can do an execution attack. You can no longer slash upwards.
Right.
It feels like an artificial thing to get you to use the next weapon to me.
Mm-hmm.
That was okay. It was my preferred weapon, but also this game doesn't want you to have a preferred weapon. That's another subjective complaint I have with this.
Yes. I also preferred the Ruego Alba, henceforth.
Well, I prefer the Verdicto.
Okay.
For me.
Yes. Yeah. I just, like the parry and parrying is fun. So I liked that and, being able to get those counterattacks in. It was more useful for regular enemies. I think the one that you're talking about, the heavy weapon for this is this flail, because everything here is Catholicism based. It's a big censer, you know, for spreading incense.
Cool. Yeah.
It's a big flail called Verdicto. And this does a lot of damage and has a very wide range. You kind of swing it in an arc. You can charge it up if you want to.
It hits twice.
Usually.
Yeah.
But there's no defensive ability.
No. You can't block or parry with it. You have to dodge a lot with this. Its special ability is you can set it on fire, and it'll drain your MP and it'll do a lot of damage. Part of the reason why I preferred this item is because I think most of the enemies in this game have more hit points than I want them to have.
Yeah.
Even basic enemies took longer to kill than I wanted them to. I wanted those fights to be over.
That's what I meant earlier when I talked about the combat getting just a little bit too punishing.
Yes.
The main way that they make this harder is to skew the numbers out of your favor.
Yeah.
HP sponge enemies that will chunk away 1/3 to 1/2 of your hit points if you get on the wrong side of it.
So I favored a big heavy hitting weapon to make things end faster.
Right.
The downside, and this is my fault, this isn't a criticism of the game, but it colors my experience. Favoring this weapon, like, one, they don't let you favor a weapon. Like, we'll talk about that. But favoring this weapon meant that I fought most enemies the same, which was a jump attack and then dashing back out of range of their counterattack. And just having that same kind of fight.
Yeah.
Over and over. When I said, this is my fault, I'm doing a degenerate playstyle, I'm going to switch to something that can parry and see if it's more fun. It is slightly more fun, but everything takes fucking forever.
Yeah.
And the risk was just more than I wanted to do. in it, because it wasn't that fun to die, because this game is real weird in that, like, it's not necessarily about these combat hallways, or it's about only about these combat hallways, or about this platforming challenge, or about this arena fight.
Yeah.
You just kind of go between them. And at some point, because money was useless to me, I started just trying to avoid as many fights as possible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Once I realized that there was nothing for me to spend my money on, it was like dash, dash.
Yeah. Just dash around everything. Jump over.
Yeah.
And then get to a room where there's some platforming and be like, fuck, I have to clear this out.
Yeah.
It's going to take forever. You know, that's what you talk about, how everything in a game is constellation wise and like interconnected. That think about what that economy did. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, there is no extrinsic motivation to fight.
Yeah.
You know, that's huge in a game with this many fights. Like, that's a really big deal.
Yeah.
There's a third set of weapons. This is a rapier and a dagger called Sirimiento and Centala. Yeah. And this is fast, short ranged. It has a parry, but it cannot do a counterattack.
Right.
And then it has a momentum system. So as you attack, you get electric charges as long as you fight and you don't take hits.
Yeah.
So you'll do more damage.
This is kind of hard mode. I tried to make these things work for me because the parry is very quick. But the problem is this is basically useless against bosses, is what I found. I can appreciate that they have like a distinct concept for this. There just wasn't necessarily anything that felt like a lock that fit this particular key.
Yeah, I barely use this.
Yeah.
However, you can't just put one of these in your backpack.
No.
Because one of the things I think is really weird in this game that I don't understand why they did it is that most of your Metroidvania abilities outside of the double jump are tied to a weapon.
Right.
So they really want you to, and you can, you know, I think that there are a lot of game designers who do consider it a virtue to make you switch up your weapon.
Yeah.
Like, how can we make the person switch up their weapon? I've never really understood this. One of the joys of a game to me is getting to know a weapon and really loving it.
Yeah.
You know, like me keeping the, you know, using the pistol for all of RE4 is a feature, not a bug to me. I just really like that weapon. You get to really good at it. You can't really do that here.
No.
You have to constantly be switching. You switch to do these platforming challenges. There's not a real menu tax for it.
No.
A lot of the things are not really Metroidvania. Like, oh, the sensor can hit bells. So you can set up these timed Mega Man platforming challenges. But if I want to zip through the air, I have to use the rapier and dagger to zap through these electricity mirrors.
Yeah.
Thing.
And so once you know, master the ability to switch these things on the fly to get through the platforming challenges that they bring you here, then that's pretty much it. It's just a matter of executing it. So it's not necessarily like engaging with the space as much as I would want to.
It's not engaging with the space, and it's breaking the rule of double duty for a key.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, if this weapon just rings bells, you know, that's not very exciting.
No.
You know, as a thing, does that feel worth even the small tax of like switching weapons to ring a bell? You know, eventually they mix it up where you have to kind of understand the order of switching.
Yeah.
And everything. And it just kind of becomes part of inputting the combo.
Yeah.
For it. And I can understand how that might appeal to some, but it wasn't good to me. Like, very subjective, but I didn't have that much fun with it.
It edges into the easier side of like a massive core platforming kind of thing. When it comes to those, it's just like, okay, I understand exactly what I need to do here. I just have to you know, get my hands to do it, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, so like, yeah, you've got the ringing the bell, you've got zipping through mirrors with the rapiers, and then the curved sword, you can do like a downward like slam kind of thing that creates flames that will burn like thorns. Wooden vine kind of things. Yeah.
Yeah. So you pick one of these three at the beginning, but you'll pick up the rest as you go into the three major areas of the game.
Mm-hmm.
The other major upgrade system that is tied to your character, not tied to equipment, is Marks of Martyrdom, which you spend like skill points in this. And this is how you unlock the core features of your weapon.
Yeah.
This is tied to specific weapons of this. I find this to be a pretty unexciting upgrade tree, to be honest.
A little bit.
Like, it's not the worst thing in the world, you know. But again, I'm trying to recreate the feeling of playing this and like looking for treat, like looking for a Gary treat, like looking for something that would make me feel really excited.
I want treats.
And getting a new Marks of Martyrdom very rarely excited me.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that has to, a little bit has to do with like using this to unlock the core abilities, like the ability to supercharge Veredicto, supercharge the flail. Yeah. That's something you unlock, right?
Yeah.
And once that's unlocked, it doesn't really, it does not necessarily change the choices that you make with the weapon, nor are you making a decision about what kind of weapon this is going to be. Really,
it reminds me a lot of the weapon art skills in Sekiro a little bit.
Yeah,
you know how you would get those different, like this is this kind of technique. It's like an upward and downward slash, and they would demonstrate it, and I'd be like, I just can't get that excited about this. Mm-hmm. The pace of the game is such that I need to be thinking so defensively.
Yeah,
in this, figuring out how to achieve a slightly wider boss opening to mm-hmm. do slightly more damage.
Yeah.
Is hard for me to be excited about.
A lot of these also have to do with an elemental damage system that is poorly communicated, let's say, and of dubious efficacy. And that permeates a lot of the character customization stuff. A lot of what you get is more miasma damage, higher defense to mystic damage. And again, it is hard to get excited about.
That is how I found that this might be entirely subjective, right? Like some people might really dig this upgrade, this, the skill tree. Mm-hmm. For me, it was hard for me to care about what I was unlocking.
Yeah.
Again, bad feeling. Mm-hmm. You get that currency, as we mentioned, the Tears of Atonement. You don't lose these on death. You mm-hmm. buy items and you confess to reduce your guilt. If you don't feel like making your corpse run.
Right.
And then there are two kinds of, ring slots in the game, basically.
Yeah. So you have your rosary. This returns from the first game. You find mm-hmm. new knots for it that give you more slots. And these are beads that you find that you can equip that will change your resistances and give some like minor conditions, you know, less
you do
guilt
slightly
loss.
More damage, take slightly less damage, things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's a new system, which is called the Altarpiece of Favors. These are expandable to 8 pieces. Spaces, but you start out with 2, and it's 4 sets of 2, mm-hmm. and you put these card figures in there that give you combat advantages, and you can kind of specialize your abilities with particular weapons this way, and because of how they're arranged, you can get synergies. If you put 2 related figures together, they'll give you more of an effect.
Mm-hmm. That was neat.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. It was, fun. So a lot of these are, figures of characters from the first game. So remembering mm-hmm. what those were, thinking about their effects and seeing who I could, pair them up with and getting rewarded with that. That is cool. That's a little esoteric. I would say this is also something you can look at the Blasphemous Wiki, and see if you're trying to get a particular advantage, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. A cool idea, the way you get these is by finding collectibles out in the world. Like, you don't find these. Mm-hmm. You go and find a collectible and then turn it into a guy.
Yeah.
That felt like an unnecessary step mm-hmm. to me rather than just finding these.
Yeah.
The game has added more collectibles, including collectibles that gate the final ending of the game and some basic systems. So it's not just lore things. There are a lot of collectibles mm-hmm. in this.
Yeah. Some of them are collectibles that gate like some basic systems. Returning is the idea. So it's a little bit easier. In the first game, you had to find some collectibles and then also pay a shitload of money to warp between checkpoints. Here, you just have to find enough collectibles. So at least there's that. There are a couple of examples of that, and I have mixed feelings.
Yeah. So those are the things that, you know, the basics of how you move around. But then there are a couple of prevalent kind of gameplay modes that it goes into that are worth talking about.
These were a constant pebble, especially sharp pebble in my shoe. Sometimes maybe like a splinter. I don't know.
I don't like any of these changes, and they're cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and when I say that, like, I want to make sure that it's clear what I mean. Like, it felt more contained and game designy.
Very discreet.
To me.
Yeah.
Very discreet and very like, okay, now time for this.
Mm-hmm.
My perennial example, that is always Tomb Raider 2013.
Yeah.
You know, a game I had fun with, but it was always just like, oh, okay, I just walked into a waist-high wall. Here's a stealth, or here's a stealth section. Oh, I just walked into an area without waist-high walls. This is a combat section.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just always knew exactly what you're going to do. Here, that makes that like super text.
Yes.
You, so platforming. Specifically like kind of masso platforming, light masso, So you'll have some kind of jumping puzzle. These are almost always timed.
Mm-hmm.
They love to do the thing where you hit a timer and then have to execute a series of things. And if you fail, you start over.
Yes. And failing almost always comes down to you didn't clear this area of enemies first.
Yes. So there's an order of operations. Oh, there's a puzzle here. I have to clean house. You walk in and you kick your brother in the balls.
Okay.
Yes. You have to clean house and then you do this thing and it's just an execute. It's not just about execution. It's just, can you do it fast enough?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I've never liked that. Here's a time thing to get under a door. This is all that.
Yeah.
There are so many fucking combat arenas in this.
I felt like I had spiders crawling under my skin every time the doors came down. Yeah.
It's the thing that makes me not like the reason why Hyperlight Drifter is not in my like pantheon. Like whenever we talk about like the best games we have done for Bonfireside Chat on off seasons, I'm never thinking of Hyperlight Drifter because despite the fact that it's beautiful and fun, it's only these.
Yes.
You know, it's a whole game made up of these. This feels like a very discrete game design Lego block you can stick into a game.
And this felt like a little bit of a hack to get around the fact that there's no reason to fight anything.
Yeah, I never want to fight anything. Exactly.
They're going to stop you.
Yeah.
And just like, oh, here you go. Walls come down. Yeah, defeat wave after Sunday. Wave of these enemies.
Yeah.
What's wrong with my Sundays?
Like, it just, you go into a room, there'll be, you know, the walls will come down and they'll fight, you'll fight waves of enemies. Sometimes these will be to teach you something.
Yes.
Right? Like, I've got the wall jump ability. I'm going to fight two enemies where I have to use that to dodge them. You know? But they do, they're so prescriptive. They cheat in a way. Some of these have items, and it breaks the rule of this game, like all Souls-likes. You can get an item, and then if you die, you get to keep it.
Yeah.
You know, like, but in these, you don't.
No.
You get the item. If you die on the combat arena, you don't get the item anymore. Like, eat your fucking Sunday.
Yeah.
It's saying to you.
Yeah. And those lessons, I believe, could have been more integrated into the world, into this space with more mindful counter designs. Yeah.
Yeah. And often are. It's a lot of times it's double duty.
Yeah.
You know, so to give them credit, like sometimes they're doing something more than just saying, like, hey, we want you to fight this wave of enemies as just a gauntlet, but not to additive effect, like all the time. These are huge bummers.
Yeah.
To me, every time it happened, I frowned. I don't think the combat in this game is that fun for that. Like, it's not something I want to just engage with on its own.
No.
And then maybe the biggest one is that Blasphemous 1 had some of the biggest and most fucked up bosses in video games.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you like a fucked up guy, they're in Blasphemous 1.
Yeah. Our Lady of the Scarred Visage.
Yeah.
You know,
the reclining Pope in the glass casket.
Yep.
One of the all-time best boss designs of all, you know, in history.
Yeah.
Like, to play-wise, it was fun to fight him.
Uh-huh.
But just in terms of what that looks like, that's, like, nothing else.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, you just, a huge takeaway. If you remember nothing from Blasphemous 1, you remember those encounters.
Yes.
Right?
Now there's, like, one of them that's kind of that good.
Yeah.
Almost. Instead of that, everyone's a guy. It's oops, all Artorias. Everyone's a guy with a sword.
Yeah.
And Blasphemous 1 had a guy with a sword. And it was very memorable because, oh, shit, unlike everything else, I'm fighting a duel.
Yeah.
Now I'm all you do is duels.
Yep. Like when you got to the end and you fought Chrysanta and it was you, basically, like that was that was wild. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here it's all that. And like they're not bad encounters as far as those go. You know, they iterate interestingly upon themselves by, just introducing attacks and then making them more difficult
in AOE.
Later phases.
Can you imagine if somebody landed and had two waves of force come out from either side? Someday they'll have the technology for a game to do that, but
but we can only
hope to live to see it. Yeah. I hope that, you know, my children's children will live to see a boss land and shoot out two waves of energy.
But, the fights can be satisfying. Technically, if you're trying to figure out, okay, this is what I need to parry. This is what I need to dodge. You know, this phase is good for Veredicto. This one, I need the rapier. Like if you are here for like a particular kind of like, you know, if you're a challenge hog, to figure out these kind of technical fights, that's cool. And I'm glad that you get that. But what we lost was, I believe, something that was really crucial to the first game's identity.
It's also a thing where, at least for me, even in that kind of 2D challenge fight thing, this is kind of damned by comparison to things that do it better. Like, Death's I'm not Gambit. That type of gamer, you know, but like Death's Gambit, which had like much more concept-y things, you know, like the sniper battle, you know, the Metal Gear boss, you do that, things like that.
Yeah.
Or something like a Hollow Knight or a Grime where my verb set and my mobility was stronger.
Yeah.
And the actual just kind of like figuring out the boss felt better to that. I was more mobile and I was more enjoying the persona, you know, I guess, or embodying my character. I was enjoying it so much more that even though these, again, they feel very clean to me, like, oh, this is just going through three phases. Each one escalates exactly by the textbook, how you should escalate. You know, it just ended up feeling almost like by committee.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing to say. Like when I say too clean, that's kind of what I mean.
Yeah.
And this is aside from aesthetics.
Yes.
It's not an aesthetically devoid game. It's still a Blasphemous game. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, so if you don't know Blasphemous 1, this pulls from a very specific kind of regional form of Spanish Catholicism.
Right.
Which is the cool kind of religion, where it's all about fucked up blood helmets and shit.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, yeah. Just very insistent terminology about different different pieces of clothing, different boxes, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, this has an interesting effect, and this is something I remembered feeling from the first one as well, where it makes everything sound cool, but it also kind of turns everything into Teflon for me.
Yeah.
I have a hard time keeping all the proper nouns in this game together, and thus, you know, the story was not immediately, I'd find reference to something, and I'd be like, which one is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because they're all, and a lot of just like bespoke words for something that don't mean anything different. Mm-hmm. Like I got so mad when I found out what confraternity meant. It just means fraternity. you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it adds a very unique flavor. And there are plenty of fucked up dudes in the NPC side of this. I don't necessarily like the words that they say.
Yeah.
You know, like running into them is cool. They're cool concepts. I don't think the actual dialogue or prose in this is particularly strong.
No.
But the actual fucked up dudes are good.
Yeah. I'm always going to be down for a fucked up dude.
Yes.
I wish it did more new stuff is the thing.
Very much so.
You know, go further, go more extreme, cast a wider net. It's a Spanish studio, so it's hard to say like, hey, you know, maybe look at how Catholicism, you know, it's from a different, you know, pulling in like a different culture or something. Like it's, you know, it's a different deal, but like a lot of it just feels, that's some Blasphemous ass stuff.
Down to individual, like specific repeated elements.
Yeah.
Like you, actual ones, like not just, oh, that's more of the same stuff. That's just literally the same stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of repeated enemies, from Blasphemous 1, things like that. So a lot of it is a direct borrow from the first one.
Right. An aesthetic downgrade though.
Blasphemous no one likes one. This.
I've seen people defend it. It's
really
crazy.
Yeah. I've seen people say they get it like from the studio's perspective.
Oh yeah, no, there's a perfectly good business reason to do it.
Yeah,
but yeah, so
I've seen the business reason cited more than a fandom reason. For this. Yeah.
So Blasphemous 1 had these just gorgeous, intricately done pixel art cutscenes, right?
Yes.
That were very, you know, semi-static. They're like, there's not a lot of like action to it, but were brilliantly composed and detailed.
If you haven't played it, think Infernax.
Yeah.
A little bit, you know, with different flavor and more like beauty.
It's kind of, like between The Last Door and Blasphemous 1, it was kind of the studio's hallmark.
Yeah.
Right? Was really gorgeous pixel art. Those are gone. Those have been replaced with fairly cartoony and fairly like brightly colored and fast moving cartoon hand drawn cutscenes that really lack the gravitas and impact of the pixelated scenes from
and
the original.
All I could think whenever one of these popped up is the host for the Metalloid Maniac saying like, now let's watch a cartoon. and like, I don't hate cartoons or anything,
but I
love grimy pixel art of fucked up shit.
Yeah.
You know, like the lighting is better, you know, it just looks cooler and it was more of a piece with what it was doing.
It was more dimensional. The posing was a lot better. Here, because they can rely on, you know, animating moving camera, put more into the motion. It just feels flatter in a weird way. The primary reason for this, and this also explains why we don't have like the big set piece bosses, is that the studio's main pixel animator left following the DLCs for Blasphemous 1.
Yeah. And I don't, like, you know, I don't begrudge individuals that. Like, no, they made the product less a thing for me. I that guy did good work. I understand, again, business-wise, development-wise, why they did it this way.
Right.
It was also cheaper. For them, they talked about that. It was like much less expensive.
Yeah. I just, man, I missed it. Like I sat here thinking like, man, maybe your studio should have been more resilient. So that it didn't rely on this one person.
I don't know what I would have done differently other than trying to find somebody else who could do it.
Yeah.
You know, but it does feel a little bit to me like an error in vision of realizing like this is actually really important.
It's really close to the heart of this, actually.
It's a big part of what makes this special. Like, you know, it's okay. You can't control that person. You're not going to, you know, keep them there against their will.
No, but
you can realize that this is a core component. It's not superfluous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess, you know, some people don't think that that's true. Some people like the new form. You know, again, happy to disagree.
Yes.
Music is good. I think the music's a little bit less earwormy than before. There's a little bit less like bright flamenco guitar sounding stuff. There's still some, like, it's still the same instrument palette, but I don't know if I'm reacting to it actually being lesser or it just feeling less fresh.
Yeah. Less fresh or, you know, it matters what it's put up against too.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, if you're not digging the play and the visuals aren't sticking out to you, the music is not going to, you know, sing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I never played Blasphemous 1 with voice.
Yeah. We played it, the release version are fairly close to it, I believe.
Yes. Yeah. They added voice acting, you know, post release. Here it is there by default. What I should have done is just replaced the, I don't even know if they have the option, but just turned off the voice acting or switched it to Spanish language voice acting with English subtitles. It is really weird to be in this Spanish ass looking culture and like walk up and hear somebody speak in the King's Own English in received pronunciation.
I thought you were gonna say you should have replaced the wave files with Offspring. That's the next game we're doing.
Yeah,
like the Annunciata comes down and just goes yeah.
Keep them separated.
I want to be a custodian, idiot. And it's worth also just as a general thing, the story to this, I don't find it as mysterious.
Yeah.
As the first one, it does feel like once more from the top a little bit, like the miracle's back. I like unraveling how it got back.
Yep.
Two things, but
also the first third of the game, and then you're pretty much off to the races doing the rest of it.
then you're hanging out opening doors to get to the thing you have to fight. You know, there's a couple little plot reveals there, but it reminds me a little bit of the story of like going from the Dishonored 1 DLCs to Dishonored 2 as like kind of a reprise.
Yeah.
You know, like, I guess she's back, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But just, and it's very verbose.
Yes.
And this can be very much be a Gary problem, but a lot of the nouns of this bounced off me, you know, it's hard for me to keep my head on who was what of the holy what.
The additional flavor of, the noun soup of this, does not spend as much as the lack of clarity costs on it.
And again, there's a certain
amount of numbness. Yeah.
Right. Again, like the first time that came up, I was like, I've never seen anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
This is pulling from a culture that I'm not familiar with on multiple axes.
Yes.
You know, that's awesome. That's to be, you know, relished because that's a rare thing in games.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not Bishonen fuck jump or Guy Whitey shoot good. It's this whole new third thing. And I always love that. And the whole new third thing again, just spends a little bit less.
Yeah.
You know?
We're talking about development here. I pulled details from interviews with Prankster 101, Pocket Tactics and Tech Power Up. There's this big
Prankster
meeting.
Prankster 101.
Yes.
Name your website, anything.
people like, just no name one's it stop anything you. These days. So in 2020, while they were working on the DLCs, the studio just kind of met and just tried to decide, like, are we going to develop Blasphemous 2 or are we going to dissolve the studio?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, March 2020, you know, beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, and they kind of went halfway. So they worked remotely, you know, to stay safe, you know, before quarantines were actually declared.
Yes.
The team expanded from 17 to 25 during this time, you know, because of a larger scope project. And their goal, the Game Kitchen's goal for Blasphemous 2, was to make it more of a Metroidvania. That's not just something we noticed. They wanted that specifically. Yeah. And then they also wanted to respond to feedback about how the game felt in the hands of the first one, which was weird. You know, go back, like it did feel weird when you would mantle, when you would not mantle. Like it had a very odd feel to it.
Yeah. When you would die from a fall and when you wouldn't.
Yes. You know, and these are down to a bunch of little things. Like you no longer die to spikes in this. You just take damage.
Yeah.
They made a lot of little changes like that based on feedback that are ease of use, welcome changes.
The dying to spikes animation is still really funny though.
Yeah.
Because your guy just gets stuck on it bodily, just like flailed out across and like, ah, shit. Yeah. it looks like he fell on his keys.
if I were going to fall on a bunch of spikes, that's probably what I would try to do just to get the maximum chance of dying instantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
As opposed to just being, you know, uncomfortably impaled many ways for a long time.
Yeah, you don't want to bleed out and you don't want something to come feed on you. You really want that thing to hit the heart and then you're gone.
Yeah. Harder head.
Yeah.
You might get gut blood out.
So the developers, when they're talking about this, the biggest challenge for them was designing bosses and encounters in a way that the three different weapons it would be possible to use all three of them for each of them, varying levels of success on that, I think.
They are all possible.
Yes.
You know, possible is just it's a wide word.
Yes.
Another goal was to expand the cultural influences, so outside of just Seville, bring in hallmarks of other regions of Spain while keeping Custodia more or less coherent to itself, which it feels like they did that.
Yeah. Like with the first game, the script was originally written in Castile Spanish and then translated. But this translation and this process saw a lot of problems because it is written in this dialect, but also in this vernacular. And so sending it out to be translated and getting back a whole bunch of literal translations of this poetic and liturgical language that kind of eliminated the meaning in it. So you can see where some of the actual like dialogue problems and the Teflon-ness might have come from in that.
It could definitely be a translation
thing. Yeah.
This is a well-liked game. It got good reviews, you know, lit up the YouTube Soulsborne circuit. We don't know how well it sold.
Yeah.
So who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not the last we'll see of it. You know, if it's like Blasphemous 1, we will probably get some updates and maybe some DLC.
Yeah. So, who knows? Even though the story seemed pretty final.
It seems final to me for sure. But Blasphemous 1's finale felt not final, but like satisfyingly.
Yeah.
You know, open-ended. And they still did it. So who knows what they might do?
I don't know.
You know, the Grievous Miracle could just come back again. All it takes is somebody wanting it enough, apparently. So like, you gotta get, it's like a hung jury. You just get one person to be like, I don't know, I might think it's kind of cool if the Grievous Miracle came back. And then bam, DLC.
It's not even that. It's them saying they want something unrelated, but phrasing it poorly enough.
God, I'm hungry. And then the Grievous Miracle is just off screen, just like, hey,
rubbing his hands together.
Yeah. All right. If you end up having a segue, if you have a project you'd like us to shout out, we're doing this a little bit differently. This is the, since it's a premium episode, this is the last time we're going to do a shout out on a premium episode. These were awkward. We had a backstage discussion about it, just making it clear why this is here as opposed to where it usually is. If you have a project and you're not demographically identical to us and would like to have it shouted out, please send me an email at gary@duckfeed.tv. This episode, we'd like to shout out Pokedextrous, which is a once a week, 10 minute long podcast about a Pokemon. They're the least informative Pokemon podcast ever. The cutest part of it, reading about it, is that every time they do it, they have a smash or pass segment, and each time it's pass because they're Pokemon. Of course, you know, you're not gonna have sex with a Lickitung.
No, you know? Well,
that's weird.
Although Although,
well, I mean, like, you and the crew could. You could get a bunch of hungry boys and, like, go to town all at once if you're looking for convenience. But yeah. At that point, I think you should also all just shower together to save water, you know? But yeah, you can, this is called Pokedextrous. Official website for this. They're hosted on Acast. Mm-hmm. So like shows.acast.com/Pokedextrous. Mm-hmm. And you can search them. They're on all the podcast servers, yeah. As well as on Twitter at Pokedextrous Pod.
Nice. That is a cool idea.
Yeah. So yeah, if you have a project, shout on out. Thank you very much. If you're hearing this, this is the end of the public episode, the preview episode.
Mm-hmm. Of this. Yeah. If you want to hear the rest, you can go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv, back us at $5 a month, and not only get the beat by beat, you know, talking about the different areas on this episode, but the full version of every premium episode we have done. So there's a lot there, even before you get to bonus content and whole other shows. So
yeah, a lot of other shows. You know, Bonfires to Chat, which we mentioned. If you want to hear the Blasphemous One coverage, Real Lich Hours, our Baldur's Gate 3 show, Unfilmable, our show about horror movies, all that stuff. This is gonna be a good month for that. We're doing Barbarian. That's a good movie. Yep. A lot of cool stuff. We think it's worth it. Yep. You can also leave us ratings, reviews on Apple Podcast or Podcast Addict, and tell your friends.
Please. Yeah. And join us in thanking our producer, Gwen. Thank you, Gwen.
Yeah. Yeah, we appreciate her very much. And we will see you next week with the Dispatch.